Hello and welcome to the Shifting Lens podcast, where we are viewing the animal experience. Today, myself and Tiamat are joined by a very special guest, Melvin Chan. Melvin's a recent Master of Arts graduate at the University of British Columbia with a focus on human development, learning, and culture. We're very excited to have Melvin on before he goes on to begin his PhD this month at York University with the Faculty of Environmental and Urban Change. So Melvin's master's dissertation reviewed outcome evaluations of universal programs that incorporate live animals to promote the social and emotional competency development in children. So I'm going to throw the spotlight over to Melvin now to talk a little bit about his research and results.
Yeah, thanks so much, Rebecca. And thanks to you and Tiamat for having me on this wonderful podcast. So as you just mentioned, over the summer, I defended my master's thesis, which was essentially a literature review. And so I did particularly, it was a rigorous one. It's called the scoping review. Essentially, the idea is to provide an overview of the research literature on a particular area. So in this case, my interest was in looking at human-animal interactions, and its relationship with social and emotional development in children and youth. There are a lot of claims that, yeah, it's great. You can, you know, pet your dog, you can do these things, and it will benefit, let's say, empathy development in children and youth. But the question is, well, what is the research that actually supports these claims? In my scoping review, we found that there were 28 studies that have sort of looked at this kind of area with varying results. The majority, you know, did find, or did the of the authors, they did report positive outcomes. I think that was like 21 or 20, 22 or something like that of the studies. Some had like negative outcomes, which is interesting. We can talk about it. Some had null findings. And actually, there was one that didn't report any like post-test. Let's say, and a lot of times when you're looking at change, right, you're measuring before and after. So they didn't measure, they didn't report their after. So you don't actually know. But it seems like these programs that incorporate human-animal interaction do provide these kinds of benefits. This is another kind of outcome. But there's still a lot of issues with these programs, let's say. There are little great things about the programs, and of course, there's also areas for improvement. And so I detail some of that in my document. So I'm looking forward to discussing sort of what these, you know, benefits are, but also, you know, where I think they could improve upon.
Okay, thanks. I guess my first question for you really is what was the general assessment on the effectiveness? Did you find that this is something that should be incorporated in your opinion?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think if in a perfect world, let's say, where you know, these programs are designed rigorously, that was sort of partly an issue, that not all of these programs, for example, had an explicit what's called a theory of change, or like a logic model, basically some sort of explanation for why we think the program works. And part of that is theoretically justifying your program. Whether or not, you know, it's based on what some particular psychological theory, like let's say you're using like Piagetian, you know, psychological theory. So he's a constructivist. He thinks that, you know, you should be, working with others or something, you know, something like that, whatever you want. Or maybe you're basing it off of some kind of compassion research that, you know, if you do these things, it'll help you build your compassion. That's all a whole other like field too. Not all of the authors described that in their programs or kind of explained that like, oh, you know, we drew from these particular, you know, thinkers or these particular empirical studies to create our program. So let's say, you know, they did do that. When we're speaking hypothetically, they did do that. They like, you know, used a control group in their study, all of these things. And it actually could show that their program was effective, then I would say, yeah, probably you could include this because it is probably going to work for at least the kind of group of kids and of youth that you studied. And I did find that, again, it was like, you know, 21 out of the 28 studies or something like that. They did find positive outcomes. So they did find that it benefited the social and emotional competencies, or at least it like, you know, helped to promote these social emotional competencies. But then you have other issues like, well, how did you, you know, measure these social emotional competencies? Were these measures appropriate for what you did? For this particular age group, for the culture? Did you monitor the implementation of your program? Because if you have a program, you have some kind of curriculum document, you're giving it to people. Are the staff who are implementing your program even doing what you think they're doing or what you want them to do? So there are a lot of, I think, these not really small issues or small things, because I think they're pretty critical parts that need to be looked at before I think, you know, we can definitively say like, yes, this is something that we should implement in like all schools, and that you bring over a whole other set of issues with then implementing them in schools, or actually even in animal shelters, at your community centers, at zoos or aquariums or like wherever it is. And there's ethical issues, there's, you know, all of these things that could come up. It's unlike the field of social and emotional learning, which is a part of the education discipline, which is actually where I was trained. That's where I did my master's degree. It was in a faculty of education, where over the last 25 years, they've really like looked at what are the things you need to have effective programs. And there are things like, you know, this theoretical part that I kind of touched on, but also stuff like, is it culturally sensitive or responsive, you know, to the group? Is it developmentally appropriate? Meaning, you know, is it applicable for 5-year-olds? Is it applicable for 10-year-olds or 18-year-olds? You probably would do different things with different age groups, right? But then of course, stuff like, the implementation part of it, implementation science is also a pretty big field, I think mostly in public health. And so education really has drawn on that and has looked at different staff factors, like, you know, your self-efficacy or the training you receive, the ongoing support you receive. And so I think there's a lot that the researchers in the field, you know, looking at human-animal interaction and this kind of promotion of social-emotional competencies, I think there's a lot that can be brought into this intersection from education. And I think that will help it be more, yeah, applicable and useful in a lot more settings.
I have sort of a two-part question for you, actually, Melvin. Firstly, I think sort of we dove right into it. And I was curious if you could maybe also offer a description for anyone who isn't aware of these programs or what these programs really involve. Like what are children doing with these animals and vice versa? How is this really incorporated into education? Just for, I think the three of us are very aware of it, but just for anyone who's not aware, and sort of maybe along the lines of that, I'm also curious when I hear the word beneficial, it's like, what is beneficial? how is that gauged? Like, how is that measured in these studies that you were looking at? I'd be sort of interested maybe if there's an answer to those that kind of go together in some way.
Yeah, definitely. I'll see what I can do to bridge the two. So a lot of these programs, like you can think of it as like a manualized or curricularized program, meaning that there is some lesson plan for so many sessions, you're doing particular things. And so for example, let's say, you know, a program could have anywhere from one session. It could also last for a varying amount of time. So it could be one session for 30 minutes. It could be one session for 1 hour, 2 hours, you know, up until maybe 20, 30, 40, 50. So there are some programs that have over 100 lessons in them that last for, you know, maybe 30 minutes. It could be as short as 15 minutes, again, like whatever you want. So I forget what the average was among these 28 studies, but there were some, you know, kind of average number of lessons. I think it was like 10. There was some average duration, and it may be something like a few hours. And mind you, not all of the authors reported the number of sessions or their durations either. So that's a little bit, you know, hard. But among those who did report it, there's some sub sample. So you have these kids. Or these youth, there was a range. I included any study that had participants aged 4 to 18 years. So really just spanning, you know, childhood, adolescence, or youth. And you have, you know, these participants, maybe one day for one of the lessons, they're learning about perspective taking. So maybe they are, you have your teacher or your staff, whomever it is, wherever, in whatever context it is. Again, it could be the school, it could be a zoo, it could be an aquarium, it could be in the field somewhere. You know, let's say the lesson's about perspective taking. And so one way you might teach that is maybe you, you know, ask people to think about, you know, their perspectives or their thoughts, share their thoughts on, I don't know, on the weather or something, or about whatever it is. They might, maybe you might ask, you know, how does your friend think about it? Maybe you talk about that. Then you might ask, well, how would a bird think? What would a bird think? Or what would a dog think? Or what would whatever think? And then you might try to, sort of support students in sort of, understanding a little bit more that actually, yeah, there are other people who think different things. Not everyone thinks the same thing. And in particular, not everyone thinks the thing that you're thinking. And it's really kind of broadening that a little bit. You might use different activities, like maybe, you know, there's, I'm sure there's a way you can include a coloring activity or with a stuffed animal, or maybe you actually are going out to the field and you are looking at these sheep or looking at these birds being like, what are they thinking about? You know, what's going on, or how are they feeling like when this happens? Or you bring a dog into your classroom and, you know, let's say a student wants to pet the dog, and then you ask, well, you know, does the dog want to be petted? Like, what does the dog want? And that's also, that's, you know, all part of it. And so you do this, you know, so many times, and it would be your different ways of approaching it. And, you know, maybe you're covering different kinds of skills. Perspective taking obviously isn't the only social and emotional skill out there. It's part of one of these competencies. There are five of them. There are things like, you know, self-regulation, your self-efficacy, growth mindset, empathy, social responsibility. There's a whole whack of things that are there. And so, in each of these programs, you might target one or multiple of these skills, but also one or multiple of these competencies, which are organizing umbrellas, right? Groups of skills. And you might include knowledge, and you might include attitudes and beliefs and that stuff in it as well. So these programs are quite varied in what they're actually doing. And so when we talk about outcomes, it becomes interesting, because then you are asking, well, what are you measuring, right? And how are you measuring that? And so I don't know if I'm fully answering the second part of the question, there are things like, you know, people not reporting the reliability of these measures, or even justifying why they even chose these measures to begin with. Like, you know, let's say you have you're trying to improve empathy, and the benefit here then is supposedly, you know, a positive outcome. This increase in empathy, we think that is good for these reasons. And there's research to show that if you have, you know, if you're developing your social and emotional skills, it is associated with like improved academic achievement, which is problematic, but it is associated with that. You have reduced conduct problems, you reduced behavioral issues, and you can help, you know, you can also use it to treat mental health conditions and some of these sorts of things as well. Again, asterisks that there are some problems with how we're defining that. But the general consensus is that it is good if you are empathetic. It is good if you are responsible, which I think we can also accept just intrinsically. When it comes to sort of measuring these things, then is the empathy scale you're using appropriate for your age group, appropriate for the cultural group? Are your scores, is your administration of this measure, was it reliable, right? Like if your reliability is at chance level, 50%, like who's to say that you actually measured something at all, let alone do we think it actually is measuring empathy? If your reliability is close to 100%, that is very good. Then it means that, oh, actually you're probably measuring something. And so then you would need some kind of like validity evidence, or some basically something that sort of supports and justifies that you're actually measuring empathy, you're not measuring something else. Did these authors report this kind of stuff? No, the answer is not, many of them did not. And you should be reporting all of it, so you actually are confident in what they found. So it's interesting, because there's a lot of asterisks everywhere for, I feel like, a lot of research, but particularly in this, when you're looking at this. So I think, yeah, before we can really say, yeah, like, let's just go and start doing this everywhere, I think we need to take an even harder look at the actual evidence that we have.
Yeah, I think tying into what you were just saying about all the possible variables, one that I'm really curious about is, did any of the studies you looked at talk about neurodivergence or specifically autism? Because there are a lot of programs for animal-assisted therapies specifically with neurodivergent kids. And I'm wondering if it's something that was controlled for, something was avoided or accounted for at all in the results.
Yeah, so that was something I had mused about at the very beginning, on whether or not, you know, like clinical populations, let's say, as is very often used in the medical literature. And a lot of this, I will, you know, say is, I think, based off of the medical model. And so you're, you know, using these programs, they're interventions. It's like a pharmaceutical, except it is different, of course, in terms of what you're administering. But that is the model. And so I didn't have a particular focus on neurodivergence or on clinical populations or anything like that, because the specific programs that I looked at were deemed to be universal. And so that means that they're for all children and youth, regardless of clinical diagnosis, any special learning needs they might have. And it could even be a learning disability, for example, that's not related to autism or fetal alcohol syndrome or Down syndrome or whatever. It could be like a language disorder, all that stuff. This is a program that's meant for everyone. And generally within yet another field, it's called prevention science. And so, you know, as you can see, social emotional learning, this focus on developing these competencies, is also yet another one of these interdisciplinary fields. So in prevention science, and what's talked about a lot now is that you want to have universal programs as like a first line of defense, essentially. So you're trying to cover as much ground as possible before programs even arise, or problems even arise. And so that's why you're trying to just reach as many kids or as many people. And so for my scoping review, we excluded programs that were selected or targeted or even indicated, meaning that these are different levels of specificity, let's say, or intensity, where, you know, you have kids then who might be at risk for developing whatever disorder it is or whatever condition it is we think is bad. Or you might have kids who are really there. So you can tailor interventions to these different levels. And for my review, we were only looking at programs that were meant for everyone. It could have been that in these studies, there were kids who were neurodivergent, or there could have been a specific population that had kids who were, or a particular study that had a group of kids who were on the autism spectrum. I don't think that was reported in any of the studies. I think if it was, you could obviously do subgroup analysis. You could see, well, was it more effective for the one, you know, for kids on the spectrum or kids who were not or whatever. But it wasn't a primary focus. So despite, I think all of the research on animal-assisted therapy out there, particularly for these different conditions, it didn't fully show up in my particular review. Had I included studies that were meant specifically for those kids, then it would be a different story, because there is a lot of research there as well. But because of the topic, it was almost like, I think, unintentionally excluded based off of the design of the particular review.
Okay. So I find that quite interesting, because certain things like empathy tend to present differently in people who are autistic as opposed to people who aren't. And autism diagnosis is something that is in itself very problematic. I'll try to avoid going on a tangent about that, but particularly people who are assigned female at birth have a harder time getting diagnosed, and people who are not white have a harder time getting diagnosed. So I guess my follow-up question is, having done this study looking at programs that deem themselves to be universal, do you feel like universal is possible? How do you think the assessments really handle those unreported differences across people's brain function and learning capabilities?
Yeah, I really don't think that we can necessarily, let's say, use universal programs universally or all the time in all places, right? There was a general feeling, let's say, during the review, the actual review process, when, you know, I was selecting studies. I actually had one of my friends, she was also a grad student at UBC doing her master's. And so she was helping me with it. It's part of the rigor and all the stuff, you know, of the review, which is great. But we had discussed, well, you know, it just feels a little bit weird that we are excluding these kinds of programs. Now, mind you, so there was one of the studies that used a universal program. It's actually called the MUDEGREES program. You may or may not have heard of it. It was developed out of Yale. And it's based on research in social and emotional learning, which is, you know, a big kind of discipline, and integrating humane education, animal assisted education, all these different names for it, but bringing that together. And so it is a universal program. It is designed in a way to be meant for everyone. But in her study, actually this was a dissertation, I believe she looked at three children who were on the spectrum in particular to see, you know, did this universal program work for these three kids to develop or to decrease their aggressive, overt aggression and temper tantrums occurrence, something like that. So there, you know, that's totally fine. The program itself was universal, it was meant for everyone. But I mean, that does bring up the question, well, you know, just how does it work, you know, for these kids? And I think when we're also measuring certain outcomes, I mean, yeah, decrease in aggression or, you know, reduction in the number of temper tantrums, I think that's great. Sure, if that is something you think we should decrease, then I guess. But, you know, are we thinking about, are we using measures of, are we looking at positive skills as well, instead of all of these things we think are problematic that we want to get rid of and sort of hamper out of kids? Are we looking at, like, well, how are they developing their self-regulation? Like, is there an improvement in that? Are we looking at how they're developing empathy or developing the perspective taking or relationship skills, like pro-social behavior and all of these things, instead of looking at only the negative outcomes? Are we looking at the other side or a different side? And so I think, like, there isn't enough evidence to, like, really out there that has, or enough studies that have actually looked at that. And so it's hard to say that, yeah, you know, everyone would then benefit from this program. On average, everyone benefits. But that's, you know, obviously is a sum across all individuals. And so does a given individual, you know, like, see that benefit? Is it realized? It's hard to say, I think, without more research. And it also, of course, calls into question, as you mentioned, in terms of how empathy presents or how any of these things presents. It presents differently for different people. And so when you're using these studies, even, let's say, you know, you're looking at temper tantrums, how you're defining what a temper tantrum is, right, might already be different if you are on the autism spectrum or if you are not on the autism spectrum. Maybe it's not, it could be. And so how, right, like, how applicable is that to your population? And did you justify it, right, like, in some way for this group? I think in this particular dissertation, you know, that I included in the review, I believe she did. Did everyone else, you know, did other people do it? Not so much. And so, yeah, it's hard to say who benefits. When people benefit as well, I think, is another kind of issue too. Like, at what point generally you want to go early on in development versus later, right? Like, the thinking is that you're then preventing problems before they arise. But are are you ready? Like, are kids ready to participate in these programs? Or do they need a different program? Or do they need, you know, something else before they can fully realize their, or fully participate in whatever it is you're doing?
That's really fascinating. I mean, I guess on that note of it being universally beneficial for everyone involved, because we are shifting the lens here, or at least trying to, did any of the literature address the benefits that the other animals, sort of the dogs or the whatever else they're learning with or together with, what benefits they might reap from working with the children? Did that come up at all in the literature?
No. Yeah. In a word, no. So across all of the 28 studies I included, only three mentioned anything about animal welfare specifically. There were a number more, I think it was close to 10 or something, that, you know, reported on the demographic characteristics of the animal participants. And so things like, you know, sample size, how old they were, how many years of experience they had working in programmatic settings or working with kids and youth or whatever. But in terms of anything related to their well-being, it was essentially absent across all of these programs, which I think is very surprising because a lot of these people are in human-animal interactions or in anthrozoology. And that is obviously a very pressing concern these days. And so I think even in the cases who did mention animal welfare, one was like, yeah, you know, these horses were able to interact with each other. They were kept in the stable. They had access to like food and water, which is kind of basic, I think. And not really asking, well, did the horses consent to being there? Or if we don't think horses can consent, did they assent to being there? Or give some kind of permission that they want to be involved? Did they choose to be there? Did they choose to be there not only, did they choose to not only participate in the program, but participate in the program right now, at this time in their lives or in their day? Did they monitor to see, you know, did they increase in stress over the program? Did their welfare go down? Or, you know, did the horses show any signs of anxiety or distress or whatever, you know, throughout the program? There was really no mention of any of that. And so I think it's a huge area for improvement, and not only mechanistically, let's say, or as part of, you know, while doing these studies, we should be, you know, monitoring the welfare. Because really what it tells us, or what it tells me, and I think other people like us who might be reading this kind of literature, is that these animals are used as tools, as adjuncts to our teaching. And in one of the studies that I included, I don't think it was the words of the author in particular, but they had looked at a program that they designed as applicable for an early childhood center. And so our early learning center. So kids, you know, age 2 to 4 years. And so they had interviewed, they had done some measurements. They also interviewed the teachers who were there. And one of the teachers were like, yeah, the dog was a great adjunct. It was this wonderful tool to help these kids develop their empathy. And so the conclusion, you know, part of it is that, well, yeah, we should be doing this because people perceive this to be valuable. But I really don't think that recognizes their agency and their sentience and their abilities to provide more than just kind of like being an object that we romanticize or that we desire, that we just think is like kind of fun, because they have their own experiences. And so it seems to be more of an extractive, you know, kind of process, that we're exploiting them, because when you're petting a dog, it reduces your stress. When you're watching birds outside, it can help you feel more comfortable or whatever. But you know, how are these animals benefiting from participating in these programs? And, you know, and I guess there are animals who would really love to do that, which is totally fine, but do all of them? you know, love to do that. And they had a variety of species of animals too. I mean, that's the other complication, is that it wasn't just dogs, horses, or birds. There were cats, there were rabbits, there were snakes, there were spiders, there were elephants, there were horseshoe crabs, like just a whole whack of different species. And so what do benefits look like for each of these different species? And how can we actually involve them in a way that recognizes their ability to choose and to be and to also share if they want? Also, I don't know what that might look like, but, you know, share the experiences and just, you know, whatever they want to do with humans. Because they can also not do that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're so right. It's just, it's not, like you were saying, it's not just that absence of poor well-being or even welfare concerns, but also, like, are these interactions benefiting them, you know, due to them being suitable and interested in it, but also are they supported, you know, through rights, that being educated appropriately? Because, I mean, of course, like, all animals work, but they're really taking part in formal work. Like, they're being essentially employed for this work, right? And I guess that some things that you just said kind of reminded me of some research that was done, and I'm completely blanking on who was done by. So I'd have to maybe put that in the description or something. But I feel like there was research done, and you might be able to tell us, Melvin, on, I think it was the elderly population, having sort of the same benefit, so to speak, stroking a toy seal went then if they stroked like a dog or something. And I wonder if you think that would be a nice alternative, because you also had that emphasis on like live animals. And at first I was like, well, of course. but then I realized you probably meant like, okay, toys or something like that. So yeah, I'd be curious to hear what you think, sort of the live animals versus, you know, pet toy seals and teddy bears.
Yeah, that was, a distinction I had to make just to be clear on what it is I was looking at. But yeah, I think the research you're looking at, you're thinking, was probably by Nancy G and her colleagues. They've done a lot of work on the elderly population and on people, I think, on people with dementia or Alzheimer's disease or something like that. I know there was a systematic review she was on. She's on all of these different reviews. But yeah, looking at that, I mean, I would also say that she's quite a pioneer looking at human animal interactions and like motor development in young kids and also in older children, that stuff too. So her work is definitely, I think, very valuable, right? And obviously useful. And so, you know, when it comes to looking at these differences, which she's done in actually for younger kids as well, I think the finding is that there's something more about like having a physical animal who can live, who can breathe and is living and all of that, that is a little bit better than having like a stuffy. At the same time, there's also not a lot of research that actually has dichotomized this and has looked at, you know, are there differences in benefits or outcomes, not even benefits. It could be negative outcomes. So just to, you know, to open that. And so, I mean, personally, it's speaking from a more philosophical kind of perspective, let's say, and take, I don't think we need animals at all in these programs. I think that we can do them with just humans. And why I think that is because, so I guess it's not purely philosophical, but because of this research done in the field of social and emotional learning, that there are no animals involved in these programs. And they have lots of positive outcomes, also reductions in negative outcomes for kids, which is the whole foundation for doing this in the first place. So I think that, like, instead of just saying, well, perspective taking only applies to humans, or implying that it only applies to humans, we should just say it also applies to animals. It also applies to trees. It also applies in all of these other cases, and just broaden the definition of what we mean by social and emotional competencies. I think that, like, yeah, if there's a suitable animal, if there's a dog who's like so motivated to be with people, loves being around kids, really enjoys doing this stuff, let's do it. Let's bring this dog in and let's, like, you know, have some fun. But in the absence of, you know, knowing that about these animals, and especially for more non-traditional companion animals or wildlife or farmed animals, which I think people, you know, seem to have a hard time believing that they're also sentient, and that they, you know, they can think and all the stuff that dogs do. That I think, like, in the absence of that, like, you know, I don't know if we should be bringing them in. And I think that we're doing them a disservice, because then we can't really know, well, what benefits are there to them, or what outcomes there are for them. And are they actually enjoying, you know, doing this? And so, yeah, I think that we need to reevaluate that a bit, and kind of, you know, tacking onto this as well, within the field of social and emotional learning, very early on. So this is a seminal paper published in 2000 by John Payton and some colleagues. So John Payton's a professor of public health, I think. I forget, somewhere in the US. But this very influential paper was one of the first frameworks for, or probably was the first framework for social and emotional learning as conceptualized by an organization called the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning, or CASEL. They're based out of Chicago in Illinois. And so they're really like a huge powerhouse. They're like the leading place for anything related to social and emotional stuff. And within this seminal paper, in the first framework for social emotional learning, there is a line about responsibility, social responsibility, what that means. And that means some kind of commitment to the community. And, you know, you're looking at others and thinking about how you can create a better world, but also commitment to the protection of the environment. Nothing specifically about animals, but this line about environmental responsibility or protection, whatever, completely disappeared now. So no one talks about environmentalism, responsibility to animals, whatever, in the context of social and emotional learning. And so I think while people looking at these programs and doing the kind of research that I reviewed have a lot to learn from how to maybe develop programs, or at least effective programs for social emotional learning, you know, from this one field, I think the reverse is also true, that when we're talking about self-regulation, it's not only in the context of, you know, I'm angry at my friend, a human friend, so I need to somehow, you know, calm myself down. I think it also needs to be, well, I really want to pet this dog, but I probably shouldn't do that because maybe the dog doesn't want that or whatever. And then you have to somehow do some kind of calming ritual as well. So really extending the context and to whom these skills apply, be it, you know, again, also perspective taking, empathy, being kind. Like, being kind doesn't apply to just being kind to another person and ensuring that people have their food needs met or that people feel safe, but also for animals, and whether or not these animals are next to you, or if these are animals in your backyard or not even anywhere remotely close to you, I still think that, like, it should be part of that definition, because it is, you know, the actions that we do every day affect, right, everyone else. So it's kind of really just broadening there.
Okay. Thank you for that. I think that's actually a really great place to stop. And we'll actually be creating two parts out of this episode. So we'll release the other one shortly after, so you guys don't have to wait too long to hear the rest of what Melvin has to say about this super interesting topic. So thank you for joining us, and hope you tune into part two.
Yeah, thank you. Amazing.
Thank you.